Whether you like history or not, if you care about bravery, wisdom, passion, larger-than-life characters, and some of the most emotionally intense moments in human experience, you've come to the right place. Daniele Bolelli is a university history professor, writer, and martial artist, and he shall be your guide in a journey to the place where history and epic collide.
Welcome to episode 25 of History on Fire. A few quick pieces of news. One, I overcame my laziness, partially thanks to the help of the sweet folks from the History of Westeros podcast, and started a Patreon account. So in case you want to check it out, whether you are because you are in a generous mood or because you like some of the perks that are part of it, you know, I'll give away episodes early to people who are donating. There will be access to the old catalog, bonus episodes, things like that. Or maybe a combination of both. You like the perks and you happen to be in a generous mood. Either way, if you can, please go check it out at patreon.com/historyonfire. Again, that's patreon.com/historyonfire. That would be sweet. In the meantime, while we wait for Patreon to do its magic and start growing over time, I would like to thank the sweet sponsors who help keep the light on. This episode of History on Fire is brought to you by 23andMe.com. 23andMe.com is a genetic service that can help you discover where your DNA comes from around the world. You can learn what percentage of your DNA comes from places like Italy, Finland, East Asia, and Africa. With your 23andMe reports, you can explore your connection to the world in a whole new way by traveling to the places that reflect your DNA. Visit 23andMe.com/HOF. Again, that's the number 23, the letters and me, .com/HOF, obviously for History on Fire. And that's where you'll find out where your DNA destination lies. Also, big thank you to BlueApron.com that has been sponsoring us for this entire year. This October, Blue Apron is celebrating its 5th anniversary by bringing back its top 20 recipes from throughout the past 5 years as peak by the Blue Apron community. One of the things that often people forget is that Blue Apron really doesn't repeat recipes. It's always new stuff, which is why this is a kind of a celebratory thing to bring back the top recipes from the entire career of Blue Apron so far as peak by the public. It's weird. It's on one end, sometimes I'm like, oh, I wish they redid this recipe again because I really like it a lot. But at the same time, every single recipe I've tried is so good that I enjoy the variety. But I'm happy with this idea that I will get to get some of my favorites again now. So try out Blue Apron's all-time customer favorites by going to blueapron.com/onfire. Again, that's blueapron.com/onfire. Where as a special offer to History on Fire listeners, you will get $30 off your first meal with free shipping. Also, thank you to the two sponsors that have been having my back from day one. That's Onnit and Datsusara. Onnit has 3,000 good products that I love. They have everything from supplements to special foods to workout gear to clothing, you name it. But one thing that I've been using quite a bit has been their Alpha Brain instant formula. I noticed that it really wakes me up. So I often use it before a podcast. I find that everything clicks a little better in my brain. So check them out. There's a free trial with it. You can go at onnit.com/history. Again, that's onnit.com/history. You'll get an automatic discount this way. And if you happen to try their supplements and you don't like them, you can return them and get your money back. So as easy as it gets. And also, last but not least, big thank you to Datsusara. Datsusara make computer bags, backpacks, pretty much any other gear made with the finest hemp available. So if you want to check them out, you find yourself in need of a bag of some kind, go to dsgear.com. Again, that's dsgear.com, and see if what they have to offer is to your liking. If you didn't catch any of the above websites, the links are in the episode notes at historyonfirepodcast.com. I'll have a couple more announcements at the end of the episodes. Today, we are going to do something different with today's episode. Today is going to be a conversation. It's not just going to be my voice going on in narrative format. We're going to have a discussion with one of the godfathers of historical podcasting. So I hope you guys enjoy it. But in either case, more on how to support the show and make sure it stays viable, plus future plans at the end of this episode. But now, without further ado, let's go set history on fire. Special guest with us today. For a change, I'm not doing just the standard narrative of the typical episodes we've been doing so far. Today we have Mr. Mike Duncan here with us. Mike, very welcome to History on Fire.
Oh, thank you for having me.
For those of, well, I'm assuming that most of my listeners, since you guys are listening to a historical podcast, you're probably already familiar with Mike's work. Because Mike was one of the, if I can call you so, one of the early pioneers of the historical podcasting genre. You started when, in 2007?
Yeah, I just celebrated my 10th anniversary. So it was, 2007.
Check you out. In 2007, yeah. I don't think I even knew what, had any idea of what podcasts were. So that's 10 years in podcasting is a lot. That's great.
Yeah, I didn't feel like a pioneer when I started because there was at that time like a fairly robust, history podcasting community. But, now I tell people, oh, yeah, I've been doing it since 2007. They're like, I didn't even know podcasting was a thing that long ago.
Exactly. And your first podcast, which was the one that we're going to be chatting mostly about today, History on Rome. That History of Rome ran from 2007 to 2012, correct?
Right.
Wow. That was you took it from just the very legendary founding of Rome all the way to the end of the Roman Empire. Is that the timeline?
Yeah. I mean, episode one was Aeneas arriving in Italy, after fleeing the Trojan War. And it's episode 179. It was the 189th episode of the series is the fall of the West, the exile of Romulus Augustulus. Of course, we all know, it's hard to say, that it's take it to the fall of the empire because we don't want to give short shrift to the Byzantines who kept the thing going for another 1,000 years. But through the fall of the West. So it was 1,000 years of history. It took me 5 years to get through it. And now, it's still, people are still discovering it. It's now 5 years since I stopped doing it. And I still get emails from people. It still does pretty consistent download numbers as people discover podcasting. And then they're like, oh, my God, the history of Rome. This is still a thing. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember I did that.
Well, that's one of the cool things about historical podcasting as opposed to one of the more chatty news-related podcasts, that it's forever. There really is no reason why somebody 30 years from now shouldn't be downloading it, because it's not like the history of Rome is going to change anytime soon. So
exactly. If it lasts, every generation writes their own, new version of the history of it, and the history of Rome can live in there as one of this generation's contributions to people understanding the history. The history doesn't change, but some of our interpretations of it can. That would be enormously gratifying and certainly nothing that I would have expected you know, when I sat down and Googled like how to podcast in July 2007, and I was just looking for a hobby. I had some creative energy I needed to blow off, and it seemed like a fun thing to do.
That's awesome. Why Rome in particular? What was it that fascinated you about this particular aspect of history?
Oh, you know, like all the ancient civilizations have always held like a real fascination for me. Mm-hmm. And not just the Romans, but the Greeks, the Egyptians, you know, the ancient Mesopotamian civilizations, and then even, you know, more modern, the Aztec, the Inca. Just they're almost like these alien societies that lived here on Earth, you know, just like a really long time ago. So from the time I was a kid, I've been really, really interested in ancient history. But at the time that I started doing the history of Rome, it was because I had fallen deeply in love with reading the ancient historians. So I was reading Livy and Suetonius and Polybius, and just really fell in love with the stories that were buried in these old, dry, dusty books that nobody ever reads anymore. And wanted to share basically what I was teaching myself.
Make perfect sense to me. It's interesting though, because Rome in particular seems to be a popular obsession. Like a lot of people are, I mean, even just the fact that your podcast, of course, partially due to its high quality, but also just the topic itself attracts people, right? I mean, Rome, for whatever reason, seems to have a hold on like collective consciousness in a big kind of way.
Yeah. When I ended the history of Rome and then took a year off and moved on to revolutions, you know, I was real nervous about whether or not it was Rome itself that was keeping people like listening to my show, or whether I sort of personally had anything to do with it, because that's exactly right. Like Rome itself is inherently fascinating and has like a magnetic pull to people. And so, yeah, like people go looking for Roman things all the time. So yeah, I was actually very nervous when I moved on to revolution. Like, is anybody going to follow me? Because like it doesn't have what Rome has, which is like this this really special attraction.
Yeah, that's funny. But I mean, I think after 3 zillion episodes, you have probably built enough of a loyal audience that they would have followed you even if you were reading your grocery list, you know, at that point.
Yeah, it turns out I was being overly neurotic.
as it's typical in this kind of case.
Well, you know.
But why do you think, for other people, I mean, I get it for you, why do you think, why Rome is this big place on collective consciousness? Why is it this thing that constantly fascinates people, where what's so special about Roman history as opposed to the history of many? I mean, many of the other civilizations you listed are very interesting in their own right, but they don't get one-tenth of the press that Rome does. What do you think is why?
Well, I mean, there's one part of it is definitely that every civilization that exists right now in the West, right, that comes out of the Mediterranean, went through a Roman period, right? So it's if you go back through the history of Britain, you go back through the history of Syria, you go back through the history of Algeria, you go back through the history of Germany. I mean, even them just fighting with the Romans, you're always going to get to this sedimentary layer of everybody's history where, oh, this is the Roman period. So I do think that the fact that it's coded into the DNA of so many what seem today to be very different civilizations, like, oh, the British and the Syrians and, you know, Algerians, like these seem to be very different, but they all of us shared this Roman period. And now we're living in North America, or you're living in South America. Well, those are all, you know, offshoots of Spanish civilization and British civilization, French civilization, which all had a Roman period. So like, you know, 2/3 of the existing cultures on Earth right now went through a Roman period. I think that has a big part. I think that plays a big part in it. The other part, though, is that they were so powerful, right? And there is a fascination with power that because they were able to spread so far and last for so long, that there is something that turns your eye, as opposed to looking at, you know, because the Greeks culturally were so dominant, but they never ruled in the same way that the Romans like ruled everything.
Definitely.
So I think that a lot of people, there's a fascination with power. Humans are kind of captivated by the idea of power. And I don't think that there's any civilization that exists in our collective consciousness, or really in the history of the West, that can claim the kind of power that Rome represents.
I think you nail it, absolutely, because you're right. It is, if you go back far enough at the roots of pretty much every Western civilization, everything is tied to Rome in one way or another. So that makes sense. At the same time, what I find weird is when you consider, for example, like when the American founding fathers made it modeling the new United States after the Roman Republic was not done on the sly. It was done in a pretty obvious kind of way, right? From iconography to even explicitly in their writings, there was this theme that they were looking back at the ancient Roman Republic as a model. And on one hand, just as you say, it makes perfect sense. It is the one place in the West that has influenced all of Western culture. On the other hand, you know, call me crazy, but picking as a model something that, due to its monstrous levels of corruption and internal factionalism, eventually degenerated into an imperial dictatorship, I don't know, strikes me as less than a good idea. I can think maybe no model is better than a bad model, you know, because clearly the Roman Republic ends, and not just ends, because everything comes to an end, you know, of course. One can say, well, it lasted 500 years, it was a powerful, great thing. Kind of, but, you know, the problems that eventually bring its downfall were there all along. And the supposedly best part of Roman history is the one that we really don't have a whole lot of sources about, so we don't really know how good it really was. By the time we really know our stuff, the problems that eventually lead to imperial dictatorship are all there. So, I don't know. I find that a little strange to pick a model that's...
Yeah, there was definitely a mythologized version mm-hmm. of the Republic that they were so captivated by. That everybody, I mean, like the Renaissance and the Enlightenment era that mm-hmm. those guys are coming out of. And this is true not just of the Founding Fathers, but you go through like the French Revolutionary guys, you go mm-hmm. through some of the guys that were involved in, you know, the English Civil Wars. They were all as steeped in Roman and classical history as George Washington or James Madison were. And a lot of it is just simply, you know, what system are you currently living under? Oh, well, we're living under these like medieval feudal monarchies. Yeah. Okay, what's an answer? What's some other model that we can go with? And the Roman Republic was sitting there as a very enticing model to get away from these corrupt, you know, these corrupt feudal regimes. And as it turns out, it's like, well, corruption and power seem to just go together, and they're endemic. And in a lot of times, you know, the model of government is not nearly as decisive as the people who are existing inside the model of government. You can have good kingdoms and bad kingdoms. You can have good republics and bad republics. So corruption is just always going to be there. But I think a lot of it was just like, okay, what are we living under? What can we get out from under it? And then, of course, you know, you take like the patricians of the United States, and obviously they're going to be very they're gonna look very highly on this little oligarchy of rich guys who get to hang out and just like run everything.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that you bring up. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention it, but you have a book coming out precisely on some of the... So let's introduce the book and let's tie it back to what we're talking about, because, you know, of course, that's a big theme in your book. So let's tell us a little bit about what's coming up. I think by the time this episode is released, it's probably going to be a couple of weeks toward... what day is it in October when your book is coming out?
It will come out Tuesday, October the 24th, 2017.
Nice.
So depending on whenever you're out there listening to this, October the 24th is the date. And it's called The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. And the idea here is to go back a generation or two before Julius Caesar comes along, and Pompey and Mark Antony and Cleopatra and all of the people who got together and very famously and dramatically destroyed the Republic in the 50s, 40s, 30s BC, to go back two generations earlier and say, well, what was going on you know, in the time of Julius Caesar's grandfather, right, or Pompey's grandfather or father, what was going on that led to the Republic being in such a dilapidated and easily destroyable state by the time Julius Caesar comes along? Because it's not like those guys entered a world where the Republic was robust and strong,
yeah,
and they just managed to tear it down. Like it was very clearly the foundations had cracked and it was becoming very brittle and very fragile. So the storm before the storm, which is, you know, that's the clever title. There was the storm, which is Julius Caesar's time. And then there was a huge storm before the storm, mm-hmm, right, which was the Gracchi and Marius and Sulla. And you find an incredible array of problems, of wars, of internal conflict and strife and corruption and, you know, ambition leading to ultimately civil war by the end of the book. I mean, there was an entire runs of civil war before the great civil wars that destroyed the Republic. And in a lot of ways, like, you know, by the time you get hopefully to the end of the book, you might be asking yourself, like, well, how on earth did the Republic even survive this? Like, I can't believe that.
Right.
I can't believe that this book ends and, like, that's not the end of the Republic. When, you know, by the time Sulla comes along, you're just like, this is it. This should be it. Like, why did it even last to Julius Caesar's time?
And in that sense, it's funny how big institutions tend to take a long time to die. Because you're right. I mean, by the time Marius and Sulla are going at it, it's obvious that it's the end. You know, that it's forces are in motions that it would take a literal miracle to bring them back. But between seeing that it's obvious that it's going to come to an end, and when it actually does come to an end, there's still, you know, people lived and die and grew their kids and, you know, generations go by before that happens. So that's interesting in itself, that, you know, yes, there may be, you may be on a train with tracks to nowhere, but that doesn't mean you're gonna get there fast.
Yeah. And I mean, half the people, I mean, everybody just sort of assumed that the Republic was going to come back. And I think that had a lot to do with why it did, why it kept surviving. Mm-hmm. Even though it was very obvious that raw power and violence were now the order of the day, and everybody sort of deplored the current state of Roman politics in the 80s and in the 70s. But, you know, the Republic had always been around and it always would be around. So, you know, that's maybe why it didn't fall.
Absolutely.
Right then. And then you even fast forward, like, past Augustus, mm-hmm, to, you know, in the ages of, like, Tiberius and Caligula, there were still plenty of people that were like, okay, well, this weird Augustine interlude is finally going to come to an end, and we're going to go back to the way that things were. We're going to go back to the Republic, that Augustus would maybe wind up being an aberration in the larger history of the Republic. And, you know, they're, of course, all deluding themselves by that point. But it never died. It never quite died.
Yeah, and you're exactly right, because, I mean, it's obvious to us now, because we do see the trajectory in a very obvious kind of way. But maybe at the time there was, you know, when the game is still in play, there's the feeling that maybe it can turn out the other way. You know, to us, it looks inevitable now. You know, once you see the stuff that you describe in the book, the civil wars with Marius and Sulla, even before Julius Caesar or any of those guys show up on the scene, it looks to us like, okay, it's pretty clear where this is going. But that's probably because we know the story, how the story ends.
Yeah, already. And I mean, yeah, and I wrote the book, you know, very clearly knowing how it all turns out.
Yeah.
And we're sort of exploring how that inevitably, or how that winds up. Mm-hmm. But it's always really fun to do history from like the ground, like from the actual people that are running around who have no idea what's going to happen next. And I really think that is where, like, really understanding the course of history is, as much as possible, trying to not know what happens next for all of these people, because they didn't know what happened next.
Definitely. And that changes all the dynamics, of course, because you don't have this sense of inevitability. You feel like some of the stuff you're doing can still change the course of where things are going. And no, that's for sure. That makes a very, very big difference. There's a quote there that I think captures sort of the spirit of where you're going with the book. There's toward the beginning, you say, surprisingly, there has been much less written about how the Republic came to the brink of disaster in the first place, a question that is perhaps more relevant today than ever. So that's kind of the setup for the storm before the storm, this idea of, you know, when is that we start seeing all the dominoes fall? Not the spectacular ending of it all, but how does it begin? And I like what you bring up at the end of the quote, when you say a question that is perhaps more relevant today than ever. There is, of course, a lot of discussion regarding parallels between what happened with the ancient Roman Republic and what we are facing in the modern world. And you make it clear that that's not what the book is about. You know, you're doing a book about Roman history. You're not a book trying to tell us about what's going on today. But of course, it's inevitable that some parallels do show up and you acknowledge some of them. What's your, you discussed this a little bit at the beginning of the book. You know, you start a comparison between the trajectory of American history versus the trajectory of ancient Roman history. For people who haven't read the book yet, what's your feel on this?
This is an outgrowth of when I was doing the history of Rome, and people kept asking me like, oh, is America the new Rome? Like this has been a question that has been going on since at least the Cold War days. Yeah. Like is America Rome? Is America the new Rome? And I always, when I was doing the history of Rome, was like, Let's not get into like those kinds of like, you know, forcing an analogy that doesn't quite work or whatever. And let's just focus on the Roman history. But, you know, enough people asked me that I started toying around with the idea. And it's like, OK, well, if, you know, let's say that we are doing something where America is the new Rome and maybe we are following a similar historical trajectory to the Romans. Where would we be on the timeline? And then you just kind of go through it. Are we at the founding period where a bunch of vagabonds get together and found a new colony or found a new city? Like, no, that was the founding fathers. The colonization of North America. We're nowhere near that. Is it the regional expansion period where you're fighting wars against your neighbors and becoming a regional power? Like, no, we did that. We took over North America and conquered the Indians, conquered the Native Americans. We became the regional power over, pretty much the Western Hemisphere. Okay, so are we at the great global conquest phase where, you know, we're defeating Carthage and becoming like the single great power? Like, okay, well, you know, World War I, World War II, the Cold War. Okay, there's something a little bit there. But then you say, well, has the Republic fallen and have we been taken over by a dictator? Like, no, that hasn't happened.
Right.
You know, as I think I actually say in the author's note, you know, despite what some hysterical commentators may claim, you know, and people always say, like, if the other party is in power, you're like, oh, they're a tyrant, they're a dictator.
Yeah, of course.
That's just par for the course, right? Yeah. Like, Democrats said it about Bush, and then Republicans said it about Obama, and now Democrats say it about Trump. So, but really, I mean, we still have elections. The mechanism of the Republic still exists. It's all actually still doing what it's supposed to do, and we have elections. Even though there are many critiques you can make about many parts of it, it's still basically functioning. Okay, so that means that we haven't gotten to the Caesars yet, and we're certainly not at the, like, oh, we're declining and breaking apart, and we're about to be overrun by, like, literally a million Visigoths. Mm-hmm. We're nowhere near any of that. So that kind of lands us somewhere between 146 BC, after the Romans had defeated Carthage and conquered Greece, but before the rise of the Caesars. So somewhere in that century, and obviously, like, I don't think we're at the point now where we're actually having dynastic civil wars for the fate of the Republic. So that means you pull it back even further and you're like, okay, well, maybe we are at this, maybe the closest historical parallel, if there is one. Is this period where the Gracchi show up in Marius and Sulla? This 50 or 60 year period has a lot to recommend to somebody who's trying to look to the past for some kind of guidance about how we're going to make it through what I think everybody acknowledges, whatever your political persuasion is. I think we all acknowledge that the United States and the West generally is dealing with some pretty major issues. We have some pretty major problems on our hands. And if not navigated correctly, it's very easy to see the whole thing collapsing.
Yeah, because the time frame that you identify as if we are anywhere on the same, this is where we are, it's not exactly a happy time frame because it's basically the right before every single South and all hell break loose. So it's one of the things where it's like, okay, you still have a shot at turning it around, but the waterfall is right there and we are headed straight over it.
Yeah, and I, you know, I pitched this book back in 2015. Mm-hmm. Like, it was really like pretty early 2015 is when I was putting together the book proposal, and it had been something that I'd been turning over in my mind for a couple of years before that. And I was hoping that it would be like prescient. You know, here's a warning for the future.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, I'm writing the book during the 2016 presidential election, which is just like, I mean, it was, I said this repeatedly, this became a running joke on Twitter, which is just, I'm writing the book as fast as I can, right? I'm writing the book as fast as I can. I'm going to try to get it to you. Hopefully it won't be obsolete by the time that the book actually comes out, because I mean, so many of the fault lines, the cracks that you could see opening up with the Romans, like they really do seem to be in play right now in a very major way.
Absolutely. There are even, you know, I was reading it with smiling sometimes, because there were some quotes there where you're obviously speaking about Roman history. There's no argument, but you don't have to look far to see the parallels. There's a quote right there that I jotted down where you're talking about the story of this consul, Lucius Marcius Philippus, and you say, in fine Roman fashion, now that a similar bill was being proposed by his enemies, Philippus opposed it vehemently. It's like, it's funny because the guy just pushed a bill that got turned down. Now his enemies push basically the same concept, and of course, so he's against it. And it's like,
so against it. Like, yeah, I mean, he went down and was like, he was trying to break up votes in the assembly to stop people from going forward with a land reform bill that I think it was like 10 years earlier that he had proposed, and quite, you know, quite dramatically, he actually provides one of the most famous quotes for people that are trying to get a handle on what the socioeconomic troubles were, where he said that there were not 2,000 men in the state who owned any property.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea here is this is even 20, 25 years after the Gracchi had failed at their attempt at land redistribution. So yeah, he's pushing land redistribution, and then it doesn't work. And 10 years later, his enemies come forward with this land redistribution bill, and he's like, "Oh no, that's evil and bad and wrong. And we never do that." Philippus. He switches sides like three or four times.
And I think that's one of the things that's funny when people draw the parallels with modern day, because one of the things that you, and I mean, maybe a degree of heavy factionalism is inevitable in most systems that allow for a plurality of voice. But at the same time, when you look at the modern political scenario, how, you know, what you just described with the story of this guy is basically to a T what people do all the time. You know, whatever idea, if your enemy pick it up and they run with it, suddenly you hate it. So showing that it's never really the idea that you cared about is more of a struggle for power, and there's just this extreme factionalism that if anybody else but my guy say it, then screw it. Then we're not going to go that way. Then it's a bad idea and we'll fight it. And
yeah, and because you can't you can't give the other side a win, right? Even if it's good rationally, even if it makes sense, even if you would sit down like at the end of the night with a drink in your hand with your buddies and say, it's actually a really good idea that we do this. But politically, from an acquisition of power standpoint, you simply can't let your political opponents have a win. You can't let them do good things for the country or for the state. Because if they do good things, they're going to be popular, and then you're not going to be able to get power. So, yeah, there are some things that are being quite nakedly exposed, I think, at this point.
And I think that's exactly one of the problems that stand in the way of anything good coming out of the modern political system, or of anything good coming out of the Roman Republic at the time when you analyze it, that when you are locked in that kind of power struggle, where it doesn't matter what, you know, whether an idea is good or not, it doesn't matter whether it can help people or not, it's all about using it as political capital to defeat your opponents, then the whole game is already done. I mean, nothing good can come out of it, because if you are locked in this deep factionalism where nothing will fly, it doesn't matter if your opponents say the sun is out, it's like, no, the sun can't be out, because if you say so, then it's not. then it's inevitable that the whole thing end up eating itself, and it, you know, it dies in a series of brutal fights between the different power players there.
Yeah, and then there, that helps you then understand the appeal of somebody like Julius Caesar, mm-hmm. right, who comes along, because what that level of gridlocked factionalism, where it's more important to score points or not let your opponents score points in these little games of like kind of petty power politics, that if somebody like comes along and says, hey, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to cut through all of this. Like, you, the people, you hate both sides. Like, this group of political elites, they're not doing anything for anybody. They're just locked in their own little myopic political war. I'm going to cut through everything and bring the reforms and make the changes that need to be made. You know, that's appealing. I mean, Julius Caesar doesn't come in necessarily like with the people saying, oh, now we're being ruled by a tyrant and that's horrible. They're like, oh, thank God. somebody's actually going to do something. This is amazing. Like, great. You know, yeah, we're, you know, reform the calendar, right? Like change the way grain is distributed. Like, phenomenal. Let's do this thing.
And I think that's what people forget sometime about, because we remember dictators for how they end, but we rarely consider how they begin. And usually they begin with cheers and public celebration, because they are there to, at least in theory, they are there to fix a problem that people by now have had it with. They can't take it anymore. And they show up as the strong man who's going to take care of it all. And so that's it. You know, we see it with Julius. I mean, even Hitler has that same story, right? He shows up in Germany with an extremely high level of popularity because the situation was so intolerable that the guy who say, I'm against it, I'm going to rescue you from this problem, inevitably got a lot of attention and popular acclaim. So it's kind of funny because it seemed like we're stuck with this mentality that, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, that if we know that something is bad and somebody goes against it, then clearly that person must be a great alternative. And, you know, that rarely works out well, but that's I can see how that's a common trait.
Yeah, and so it, basically what that means is that there's a lot of agency that these sort of squabbling political elites have. Mm-hmm. Like, if anybody is going to be able to back us away from this, to let, you know, participatory Republican government continue to exist in a century from now and 2 centuries from now, the real power to make sure that a dictatorship doesn't sort of capture the system is to back away from this and to do more cooperative governing and ratchet down the stakes a little bit and not say, oh, well, if my enemies get something, that means, oh, the whole world is going to end. Yep. Maybe ratchet down the rhetoric a little bit and maybe let the other side have a win every once in a while, because otherwise you're just playing chicken with the entire Republican system.
Which is exactly what they were doing and leads to the consequence that then eventually we can all see. So, right. Yeah, that's there's another quote that you threw in.
So
there.
This has been happy fun time on.
Yes. you know, barbarians will be knocking at the gate.
Right. Okay. So, okay. There's another quote you said.
Yeah, there was another one that I was reading and I was like, well, I see where this is going, where you said, but this was an age when a lie was not a lie if a man had the audacity to keep asserting the lie was true. Which seems right. Quite fitting considering the breakdown of the modern news system, nobody trusting anybody, the sense that at this point doesn't even matter what actually is factually true or not, is because you can always spin it as, oh, the news media is lying or this other source is lying. And, you know, people basically via social media, people believe the weirdest things that are not based in facts ever, because essentially there is no sense of objective, trusted sources that you can rely on. And so now the feeling is, you know, as long as you keep looking solid in your life, you can probably get away with it.
Yeah. And that part in the book is when Saturninus and Glaucia have pulled out the fake son of Tiberius Gracchus, where this mm-hmm. is, you know, we're talking, we're 25 or so years past the, almost 30 years past the death of Tiberius Gracchus. And these guys now want to run on the legacy of the Grokkans, and they want to capture the old like Grokkan power and Grokkan coalition. So yeah, they just bring out some guy and they're like, oh, well, this is Tiberius Gracchus's son, right? Mm-hmm. He's the son of Tiberius Gracchus. And it's not true. The leadership, the guy, the censors are not going to enroll him as the son of Tiberius Gracchus. Like Tiberius Gracchus's sister is still alive. Right. And she's like, I don't know. This guy is not like my nephew. I've never heard of him. I've never seen him before. Like this is bullshit. But yeah, who cares? Because they had successfully planted a seed that the son of Tiberius Gracchus was sitting in their inner circle.
Right.
And if you don't know who you can trust, then you can just kind of say anything. And that is definitely right now a major problem where we've lost track of even like, I don't know if it's a loss of shame or what exactly it is, but to just continue to say something in the face of an objective fact is extraordinarily troubling.
Yeah, I mean, as we record, just yesterday the Vegas shooting took place, and it's hilarious because you see those dynamics where you see the craziest, wildest stories being reported with not one trace of evidence regarding what really happened, and it's kind of like, yeah. Why not? It's a lot of people repeat them. And, you can apply this to so many different events. It seems to be like an ongoing theme that we are definitely facing today, which is funny because on one end, we have this form of, since like social media, right? Stuff that's amazing because it allows people to connect. It allows people to have access to information to a degree that nobody would have ever dreamed of in the past. And yet that does not necessarily always mean it's good information.
I've talked about this. I mean, not on the podcast or just in my regular life where, mm-hmm. We have in our pockets like the sum total of all human knowledge,
yep,
instantaneously available to us. We can know everything. We're walking around with the world, the collective world consciousness in our pockets. And usually what we use it for is to go and confirm some bias or some belief that we already hold, right? Yeah. We almost never use it to go acquire new information. We just go, we spend 15 seconds Googling up something that is, we'll skip anything that doesn't confirm what we want to confirm. Yep. And then we'll land on the one thing that confirms it. Doesn't matter if it's true. Doesn't matter if it's got 17 Pinocchio pants on fire ratings. It doesn't matter if Snopes has written, like 78 different takedowns of this. Like if that confirms your bias, you're just going to click on it and be like, see, and then you share it and that's it. Like that's what we do. That's what we do with the sum total of all human knowledge is we go find lies that confirm our biases. Wonderful.
Silly monkeys being silly God, monkeys,
silly,
right?
God, silly monkeys. Of course, silly monkeys. God, yeah. We are. Oh, humans.
It was funny because the theme that we are bringing up a minute ago about factionalism is interesting to me because not just historically, but even if you look at like a couple of the biggest TV shows out there today, shows like The Walking Dead or Game of Thrones, over and over again, they deal with the same theme, which, if you strip the dragons and the zombies and all the wilder stuff of it all, really one of the core themes of those shows is the inability of human beings to work with one another. Even in the face of a zombie apocalypse, most people seem to prefer finding ways to take advantage of one another in a rape and pillage fashion rather than join forces and work together for a mutually advantageous outcome. Same thing in Game of Thrones. You have this possible apocalypse coming and everybody's busy squabbling for power among one another. Roman history tells us the same story. At a time when cooperation could have saved the Republic, competition still ruled. And we see the same dynamics repeating themselves throughout history time and time again. Does this make you more pessimistic about humanity and human nature? Do you see it as, yeah, that is a problem, but there's an upside to it? What's your take on it?
Oh, I'm very mixed, right? Mm-hmm. Like I take a fairly balanced view of humans because it's we're talking, and I wrote a book about the beginning of the end of the Roman Republic. Mm-hmm. it's very exciting. But one of the things that is so impressive about the Romans in particular was for 400 years, no, 300 years, they ran a cooperative government without any one man seizing power, without it ever coming, without it collapsing as quickly as you might think. And I one time I went back through and I think that there were because during the Samnite Wars and during the Punic Wars, the Romans were throwing up dictators like left and right. The annually elected consuls almost like would fall away for periods of time. So there was something like 100-150 different men who had been named dictator after the founding of the Republic in 509, but before, let's say, Sulla. And every single one of them laid down power. Every single one of, like, no matter how intense the political squabbling became, at the end of the day, they, at least the elites, you know, like, yes, technically it's this little closed club of oligarchs, but they never let one faction or one man grab a hold of the whole thing. So it actually lasted for quite a long time. The American Republic, again, has many of the same problems where the political elites have kept a republic going for a very long time. For it's an impressive track record that we haven't yet fallen, even if the history of the United States is a lot of there's a lot of people who were just simply denied power outright who wouldn't know the difference between a quote unquote representative republic or a dictatorship, because either way, like, they're locked out of power and they're locked out of having a voice. But when it comes to cooperative representative government, in the United States, it has persisted. In the West generally, it has persisted. The Roman Republic did last for a long time. So nothing is going to last forever, and everything is eventually going to fall apart, and we will eventually succumb to our baser instincts. But there is something enlightened inside the human brain, I think, somewhere that has made it not inevitable. And I think even if we collapse now, it'll come back around.
And I think your mixed approach to this is exactly what also makes those kind of shows fascinating. Because if it was only gloom and doom and people just eating each other, okay, well, it gets old pretty fast and you just want to shoot yourself and be done with it. Part of what keeps people glued to the screen is this back and forth battle between these self-destructive forces that are just too narrow-minded to consider the bigger picture, and they are just busy getting what they can today at the expenses of the overall good outcome. But at the same time, you also see the best side of human nature show up sometime and try to find a way in the middle of the chaos and madness of it all to make it work, to create happiness for as many people as possible. And maybe that's exactly what human history is. Maybe those are the forces that we play with all the time, and that probably will continue to play with all the time. That there's this kind of ongoing battle inside the human mind and among human beings that will always play out like this.
Yeah, and I mean, you know this too, that you know the history of humanity has a tendency to be, and certainly I'm, you know, guilty of this, if this is a criticism you want to make of history, is that it's a lot of let's talk about this war, and then let's talk about this genocide, and let's talk about this collapse of a government. But in a lot of ways, it's a lot like watching, you know, the local news, where, you know, you turn it. There's a comedian once, I think it was Richard Jenny, who's like, we shouldn't call it the news. We should just call it the bad news, right? Here, okay, it's 11 o'clock. Here's the bad news, right? Like a fire broke out and this person got murdered and, you know, this politician is corrupt and the weather is going to be crappy tomorrow. But the reason we're being told about these bad news events is because they're kind of unique aberrations over the course of the day. And really what human history is millions and millions and millions of people pretty much peacefully going about their business with each other and having families and going to work and coming home and watching TV and playing with their kids and, you know, having picnics on the weekends. Like, the vast majority of the human lived experience is pretty peaceful and pretty calm and pretty generous and loving. At the same time that it can also be petty and, you know, full of stupid drama and, you know, stupid work drama. Like, yeah, I just don't like working with that person or whatever. But you know, these really big breakdowns, I think we do have a tendency, due to the selection bias of what is exciting and what we want to talk about in history, to focus on the really, really negative things that humans have ever done without really looking at just the day-to-day lived experience of most people. So I don't think that humans are cruel and destructive and merely just selfish whatevers. There's plenty of good in there too.
And I think it's interesting. I mean, I wasn't planning to touch on this topic because it's something that I tend to talk about a lot, but since you bring it up, it makes perfect sense. Like, do you think it's just a matter of fact that the reason why we in history we tend to focus on the drama, on the horror, on the massacres, on the nasty things, is that because that's more exciting than just listening about some lady raising her kids well? Or, you know, is that an excitement factor that does it, or what do you think?
I think there's two big things to it. Number one, yes, it's exciting, right? Mm-hmm. That's why we go see action movies. That's why we don't go see, you know, some boring French movie where two people are just talking to each other. But there's a reason why, you know, the Avengers is bright noise that everybody is drawn to, and, you know, some nice little independent movie doesn't get any play because it is exciting. Right. So that's definitely a part of it. But the other part of it is that I think that historians, too, very naturally look to when, like, the quote unquote course of history changed, like when it moved, like when did it go this way and not that way? Like, when did this government rise and when did this government fall? Like, we look for those turning points in history. Mm-hmm. And you're not really going to find a turning point in history, you know, in Farmer John's backyard, who spent 50 years peacefully raising sheep. You know, you're going to find it on a battlefield someplace. You know, yeah. You're going to find it at on Omaha Beach, right? You're not going to find it back on the home front. So I think that there's a natural tendency, if you're asking the question, like, how did we get here, to look to the places where the turns were made. Like, where did we start? Where were the turns made? So how did we wind up here? As opposed to looking at the stretches in between where the course didn't really change. And those turning points always have a tendency to be when it's like a clash of arms, when everything gets devolved to like just two physical powers running into each other and which one is going to emerge victorious. That's when the course of history usually changes.
No, and I think that nails a very important point that, yeah, if we're looking for a turning point, for revolutionary moments that change the status quo, they don't usually happen in just a gradual, pleasant fashion. They do happen with drama. They do happen with conflict. So that makes perfect sense. Absolutely.
Yes. And so for somebody like me, you know, like I mean, I do revolutions and, you know, an exploration of the great political revolutions that changes the course of history that then just has the added bonus of course, being exciting and compelling enough that you kind of want to find out what happens next in the story. While at the same, and you know, the stakes are really high, you know, like all the stuff that you want out of drama is all present. And it also just happens to inform how we got to this spot in 2017. Like, how did we wind up here?
Speaking of drama, what's your take on the many recent versions of Roman history on the big screen? Like, for example, we have had, starting with Gladiator, which I think is the thing that brought back Rome as a viable topic for movies. Then, so we had Gladiator. Among some of the big ones, we have seen the HBO series Rome. There was more recently the Spartacus series. What's your take on some of these cinematic adaptation of Roman history?
I have never honestly been too impressed with most of it, mm-hmm. which is this is a fairly common, like, what's your favorite Roman history movie? Like, I loved Gladiator when mm-hmm. I saw it when it came out, because it was a great big movie. Now that I'm completely steeped in Roman history, to go back and watch it, you're like, okay. I mean, yeah, all right. all right. And then just some of the other ones, like there's various movies that are just not very well done as movies. Mm-hmm. So it's like you don't even get to, oh, is this a good depiction of Roman history? Because it's not even a particularly compelling movie, which is the first thing that it needs to be, which at least, I mean, Gladiator had that, right?
Yeah.
So it was a compelling movie, and then you start to ask how good it was. I did really like the Spartacus show that was on Stars, which is so over the top. And such, the sex exploitation, the violent exploitation. Yep. Right? I mean, just they just cranked everything up to 15. But you just kind of feel like whoever the guys were that were making the show were like they just so gleefully embraced it.
Oh yeah,
you know, like
that was most explicit sex. Other than porn, you know, it's like anything past that point is just straight up porn. You know, there's nothing left in between.
Yeah, it was and the only thing that was left in between was like incredibly graphic violence.
Yeah.
So it was incredibly graphic violence, like intercut with, softcore porn. So it was it's a highly entertaining show, even if you wouldn't necessarily recommend it to your kids.
What about
my answer, my favorite Roman history movie is Cleopatra, is the old Elizabeth Taylor, Rex Harrison and Richard Burton. I love that movie. A lot, because it was really clear the guys whoever put the screenplay together was writing out of Plutarch and writing out of Julius Caesar's commentaries and writing out of Cicero. It was really clear that whoever wrote it was pretty well steeped in the sources. So that depiction of it is, I think, has always been my favorite.
How about the HBO series, the Rome?
I'm really conflicted about that, because they did such a great job with the look and feel of everything. I really enjoyed that. The guy who played Julius Caesar was great.
Yep.
He couldn't take your eyes off him.
Yep.
But again, the first thing you need to look at with fiction and with drama is like, are you enjoying this as a TV show? And like, Varinus is one of the main characters, and I hated Varinus. The guy he sucked.
Yeah. So it was completely obnoxious. I like the other guy.
He was a horrible character, and he was one of the main characters, and I think somebody that we were supposed to be sort of identifying with and rooting for, and I couldn't stand the guy. And Pulo was just kind of an idiot, and they did stupid things. So from a script writing standpoint, many of the character arcs and storylines of Rome, I was not able to enjoy.
Right.
Even if it looked great. And then, like I say, the guy who played Caesar was sensational.
I had a soft spot for Pulo. I think, intelligence is highly overrated. And so I like his cheerful stupidity.
The thing is, like, if you watch it, like, he gets a brain transplant between season one and season two, right? Like, he's just a dunce in season one, and then season two, he's like advising Octavian on what to do. Like, I don't know what is happening in the series. I can understand why this is being canceled. Also, it was a financial boondoggle for HBO.
One of the things that also I find interesting, though, is that in some way, for me at least, some of this representation, especially the HBO one, was interesting as... because I'm sure your perspective of Roman history might be so different from mine, just because I grew up with this stuff all the time, right? Growing up in Italy, you hear about it when you're 5 years old, and then they tell you again the whole thing when you're 6 and 7, and you just repeat this story for like 15 years of your life. They keep going at it. To the point that on Italian newspapers, like in some title of an article that has nothing to do with Roman history, there will be some really obscure references to Roman history that everybody's expected to know about, just because, you know, you're bombarded with this stuff day and night. So I hated Roman history growing up. I was just like, enough of this crap. Can we just talk about something else already, you know? I just found everything else on Earth fascinating except Roman history. But then once I started kind of when I was older and getting a different take on it, not hearing it from the million time the way I heard it in Italy, but seeing it sometime through these eyes, through the HBO eyes or through something like that, I'm not saying it was the most accurate thing in the world, but I found it very helpful to discover what was actually... Like, I found it easier to like it with outsider's eyes than I did when I had insider's eyes on it. I found myself then seeing, oh, now I get it. Now I understand why it's a big deal. Now I understand why it can be a fun topic. So I don't know, maybe it's just because of my own personal experience, but I tend to have a somewhat forgiving take on some of the cinematic versions of it, just
sure.
because they are what led me to sort of rediscover Roman history.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. And, you know, and in the United States, like, our version of that is like the Founding Fathers, right, where it's just that story over and over. And but you guys got Rome, right? I mean, how, yeah.
I think it's one of the six. It's kind of like, you know, we're before we started recording, I was telling you, I'm living in Los Angeles. I look outside and it's sunny all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, another day in the sun. What crap? Can we get some winter already? You know, that's one of the issues. People, you know, the grass is always greener kind of thing, right?
Yeah. And I had some nice, you know, I did a whole series on Spanish American independence on Simón Bolívar and, you know, José de San Martín and those guys. And I got some really nice emails from Venezuelans and from Colombians and people in Argentina who were like, this is really great. Because I think probably in the same dynamic that you're talking about, where they're kind of bludgeoned year after year with the same mythologized version of these guys, to the point where you get to be 15, 16 years old and you're like, I hate Bolivar. I hate him. He sucks. I never want to hear about this guy ever again. And then when I sort of went through it from an outsider's perspective, just talking about what they did and how they did it and why it was important, they were like, this is good. I'm actually enjoying this guy who I've literally hated my entire life.
Yep.
I'm sort of enjoying your take on it. So those are some of the best emails that I've ever gotten in the course of doing like any of this.
But it's true, you know, that does. And I mean, even in the book, for example, you do bring up, there are a few moments where you tell the story with such a different perspective. For example, when Marius is dealing with the invasion, I don't even know how they say it in English. Is it Cimbri or Kimbri? Or
oh,
how do they pronounce it?
Kimbri.
Kimbri, okay.
Kimbri is what I'm going with.
When the Kimbri are invading, you actually present a very sympathetic view of their situation. You know, you provide some logical reasons why they were doing what they were doing. Whereas, you know, the typical version of Roman history make these guys just look like zombies coming from outer space who are there to invade everything that's good and holy. And instead, you made a very logical argument for why these guys were there, why they actually tried to be nice about it, and instead they kept getting antagonized by Roman generals. And in some way, you know, what seemed like a very straightforward story, suddenly it gets a lot more complicated because you added a lot of humanity to both sides and to their motivation. So I thought that was a really interesting spot in the book.
Well, I'm glad that worked. I spent some time trying to figure out what the Kimbri were up to, because certainly the Romans themselves didn't put a lot of effort into trying to figure it out. So you never know. It's just like they would disappear, and then 4 years later they'd show up again, and the Roman historians are just like, oh, and then the great horde of barbarians came and we had to go beat them again. Yep. Like, actually, you lost like every time that you ever fought these people except the last time, which is very Roman. That's like the most Roman thing of all, is to like lose 20 battles in a row but still win the war. Like, that's how the Romans actually conquered the Mediterranean. But yeah, just to try to figure out like how to make, like, what were they doing? It's still a mystery. I wouldn't have like a good answer. You know, all we can do is just like speculate a little bit.
Yeah, but that was a very good speculation because it sounded very reasonable based on the facts. So I found that very interesting. Now, speaking of your style of telling history, there's anybody who does historical podcasting has to figure out the balance between a more narrative storytelling side and a more academic, rigorous side. You know, on one extreme, you end up telling fun stories that have nothing to do with history. At the other extreme, you become, you may be totally accurate, but you're deadly boring. Where do you find the sweet spot for you? How were you able to kind of find your voice in terms of doing something that's still very much based on the sources, but that people would want to listen, not when they are stuck in a classroom and where they have no choice, but where, you know, with podcasting, everybody has a choice to turn it off at any moment? How did you go about it? What was your method, if there was one? How did you, you know, where do you feel you stand in that continuum between these two opposites?
I didn't ever sit down and think it through. Mm-hmm. I was very much making it up as I went along. Like, I mean, when I started, I didn't really know what I was doing. I just knew that I was really into Livy and wanted other people to be into Livy too. But I think for me, if you want to explain what happened in history, mm-hmm. you do it chronologically.
Yeah.
I think that's how you keep people's interest, that it is stories of people doing things. And today it was like this. And then the next day they did this. And then a month later they did this. And a month later they did this. And that chronological unfolding of events will lead itself very naturally to times where you can be like, oh, and then when this happened, like this opens up a wider discussion of how the society transformed, or how, again, we went in this direction or that direction at some turning point, or why this individual is important, or why this, why this event is important. That having that chronological thread is what is going to keep people interested on sort of a minute by minute basis. Whereas if you go with these more like thematic, like, okay, well, now we're going to talk about the nature of democracy, or now we're going to talk about, you know, some abstract concept of, you know, power versus the individual. I think that you can lose people really easily, where if you keep the story going, when you tell a chronological narrative, the paragraphs seem to just come of their own volition when you want to peel off and go on a little digression or make some more analytic point as opposed to just keep the story going. So I'm doing this even still today. Like, I'm working like purely on instinct, right? Mm-hmm. Where I'm just sitting down, like right now I'm trying to explain the revolutions of 1848, and I'm just trying to explain what happened on February the 22nd and then February the 23rd and February the 24th. And you can see in there when the moments are that you need to stop and say, and this is important for this much larger reason. I think that those things just kind of come of their own accord. I've got a knack for it. Like, maybe I did find what I was supposed to be doing with my life. Because these things do kind of come instinctively. I never really have to force it.
That makes perfect sense. How would, for example, would you compare your style to, you know, you have people like other pioneers of historical podcasting, like Dan Carlin. You know, he had a couple of series on Rome. He did Death Throes of the Roman Republic, which is basically kind of where you start with your book and then continues with Caesar. He did the one about the Punic Wars. Every one of us has their style of doing things. How do you think, like, compared to what the way Dan tackled the topic, how do you think... If I can force you to be a little self-reflective on this and look at it from the outside, what do you think is your take compared to the way Dan Carlin would do?
What Dan does, and what he does so well, and why he's so popular, he does really immersive history, mm-hmm. right? Like it's almost like a virtual reality thing that he's trying to do. Where he wants to put you in the middle of the action, and he will keep painting and describing the way things are, the way things look, the way things sound, so that you can really, like, you would close your eyes and he's putting you back in that place. That's his style, and that's why it works so well. And he's so good at it that's why it's so popular. Mm-hmm. My stuff is more like I'm reading you a book about Roman history, right? Where I'm never like, and then, you know, you can feel the rain, you know, on your face, and then, like, and then you get hit with blood, and then, you know, somebody's hacked your leg off, and you're like, how does that feel? Like, I don't really go in for that sort of stuff. I have just I'm writing every week, you know. And Dan's also, he's just kind of like talking off the top of his head,
yeah,
because he comes from from like a talk radio background. Mm-hmm. Whereas I'm writing a story and then reading it to you.
Gotcha.
And that's how I approach it. So I think that's like a big difference. And I think both styles have things that have strengths and weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
Just like everything has its strengths and weaknesses, except Superman. Superman has no weaknesses.
Yeah,
which is why
he's kryptonite. Not really kryptonite.
Which, well, yeah, that's true.
There's always one, at least. There has to be one weakness.
Yes, Green Lantern is stopped by yellow or something.
Yeah, you know, that's how it works.
Okay.
If I can bug you with a couple more things, in terms of characters from Roman history, I mean, there's clearly such a long history there, so many fascinating figures. Is there kind of one or two that stand out for you as people that just as human beings you are kind of captivated your interest, that whether in a good or a bad way, you know, but somebody where like you kept going to studying their biography, being into their story as a person?
Yeah, there's I have a real love kind of for anybody that I feel like I discovered on my own. Or sort of these like secondary figures who don't get talked about that much. So like in the history of Rome, like I discovered Aurelian buried in the crisis of the 3rd century, because I'm sure you probably have found this too, that like every history of the later Roman Empire is just like, oh, everything fell apart in 235, and then it was put back together in 285 by Diocletian. Like, don't worry about this 50-year period in between where everything went to hell. There was, you know, 37 emperors in 17 years, and like it's just a big old mess, and we don't have very many sources about it. So, like, just don't worry about it. Just you can skip this part.
Yeah.
And you're always told there, books and everybody tells everybody, like, just don't worry about that period. Well, I wanted to get into it when I did the history of Rome, and when I went into doing the show, I knew nothing about it. And yeah, buried in the middle of the crisis of the 3rd century is like the Emperor Aurelian, who. In 5 years, like he accomplished more in 5 years than almost any other Roman emperor in history. Like his little reign, which nobody ever talks about, nobody ever points to, nobody ever celebrates or even criticizes, right? He's just he's a complete non-entity. So Aurelian is somebody who, and I will come back to Aurelian. Hopefully, if this book is a success, if everybody pre-orders the book and then, you know, it sells a bunch of copies and they let me write more books, I definitely do want to go back to talk more about Aurelian and the crisis of the 3rd century.
Would you, if things work out as you would like and the book is a great success and all of it, could you jump straight there, or would you have to do a more of a chronological thing and go through, you know, go back to then Julius Caesar and all of that stuff, and then Augustus? Like, what's...
No, the grand plan that nobody knows about this grand plan. I don't even think my agent knows about this grand plan yet. There's so if this book works, there's going to be a second book. Mm-hmm. And I know what I want the second book to be. I'm actually putting the proposal together for it right now. That I won't tell you what it is, but it's not Roman history.
So that's
the thing. I do want to kind of make the same move that I did after the history of Rome and do something that is from, you know, we're in a leap forward to the modern world, and I have something that I would very much like to talk about,
nice.
Sort of modern revolutionary world. And then if that book works, then yeah, I would come back around, and I would love to write a book about the crisis of the 3rd century.
Yeah. That's cool.
Because you can't just do, like, I mean, the logical thing is to say, oh, do a biography of Aurelian. And say, well, there's actually literally not enough material. There's one pretty decent treatment of him that a guy wrote maybe 20 years ago. But, I mean, the snippets that we have to go from, it's like analyzing coins is all we have.
And right.
So you can't – it would be hard, I think, to fill an entire – biography just on Aurelian, so I would just have to bury him or make him the central pivot of a wider book about the crisis of the 3rd century, which again I love periods in history that are somewhat neglected. I always have enjoyed shedding light and like look at what happened over here, you guys, like we never talk about what happened over here, and the crisis of the 3rd century is a big version of that. The Haitian Revolution was another one.
Well, let's talk a little bit about revolutions, because I mean, right now, you know, we wanted to bring up your book, since that's what's coming out this month, and Roman history, since that was your number one hit, starting with the history of Rome. But now you have been doing revolutions for quite a while. What's the trajectory with that one? Because you have covered already quite a few of the biggest revolutions in modern human history. How many do you think you have left? Do you see yourself going for a third series after revolutions? Kind of what's the status now on all of that?
The status of revolutions is the same as the status of the history of Rome was when I was stuck in the middle of the history of Rome, which is, I don't know when this is ever going to end.
Right.
So I'm in the middle. I've just started, or I'm smack dab in the middle of the revolutions of 1848, which is really like the halfway point. This is great. So once I get through 1848, you know, I want to do the Mexican Revolution. I want to do the Russian Revolution. I would like to do the Cuban Revolution. And, you know, I've said this, that I would like to carry it forward and do a series, however long or short, on the Iranian Revolution, because that has there's a lot that people, you know, there's a lot that people don't understand about what happened in Iran and why things happened in Iran the way that they did. So I would like to sort of get to that point. And then after that, like, we're really into current events, and there's not much more. I'm not going to do like the fall of communism or the Arab Spring or anything like that.
Right.
So I feel like I've got at least four or five more complete series. Like, I'm in my seventh series. 1848 is a beast and will take me probably 30 episodes or more to get through, because it's like 5 to 12 simultaneous revolutions. It's for sure the most ambitiously complicated thing that I've ever tackled, because even like the French Revolution, is nothing is probably ever going to be as long as the French Revolution, which wound up being, you know, 55 episodes long. But that was at least just one very complicated story. This is like 5 very complicated stories all happening simultaneously.
Right. No, that makes perfect sense.
It's fun. I'm losing my hair.
I'm fascinated when you say that you are going to tackle possibly the Iranian Revolution. That looks really juicy as a topic, and, you know, good luck, because that can get you into some serious political hot waters there.
Yeah,
it's tied to modern history.
Yeah, and I just want to walk through it. Like, that's it. I just want to like let's just open our hymnals to, like, I don't know, the end of World War I, and just sort of talk through what happened. That's all I really want to do.
That sounds like a very sweet idea, but seriously, good luck.
Thank you very much. Maybe I'll have quit by then.
Yeah, talking about what happened. Of course, you know, there's going to be 3,000 people having different opinions. Because, you know, as long as we talk about stuff that happened 3,000 years ago, nobody has a vested interest. So people can be like, oh, that's what happened. That's it. When you start bringing up topics that are very much tied to today, there are a lot more people with skin in the game, and of course the emotional reaction rather than just one based on evidence tend to rise up. Like, I was considering, there are a few stories that I would really badly want to do, and they are fairly modern history, like 1970s, 1980s, stuff like that. And every time I start a research, I'm like, do I really want to do this to myself? Because I love the topic, but I can already hear the complaints. Doesn't even matter how I'll slice it or how I'll tackle the topic, there will be people who are emotionally invested, will be upset. So that's
I'm going to do Cuba. And that's going to be
another easy one. Good for you.
That's going to be the same thing. But my hope, like, this is naive, like, we can timestamp this. You can email this to me when I'm 2-3 years from now, when I'm buried in some controversy over my take on the Cuban Revolution. But, you know, I've done the Haitian Revolution. I have done Spanish American independence. There's a lot of groundwork that I've already laid for what my take on Cuba will be. Mm-hmm. I will probably inevitably make everybody mad, because, you know, my basic take is that there's heroes and villains is not a great way to do history. This is, people have interests and people want power, and they run into each other. And that's a lot of what my that's a lot of the stories that I do. Mm-hmm. So I think by the time I get to Cuba, you know, I've done a ton of I've laid a ton of groundwork on what post-colonial, you know, the post-colonial Caribbean looks like to begin with and where it came from and why it came from, because I'll have done the Mexican Revolution by that point as well. And then it's just people looking for power running into each other.
And add the dragons and you have Game of Thrones, right?
Exactly. Yeah, right.
Perfect. That sounds good. Anything else you want to throw out there before we wrap things up, whether about the book or your podcasts or anything else you want to mention to listeners?
Oh, just that the book is coming out October the 24th. It's The Storm Before the Storm, the beginning of the end of the Roman Republic. And I'm quite proud of it, you know? Like, you sit down with a blank piece of paper and you like I sold the book, right? Like, I pitched the book on basically on spec. Like, this is the book I'm going to write. It's not like I had the book written and then took it around to be sold. So I was quite happy at the end when we put the final, you know, period and said the end. Like, wow, this turned out a lot like I wanted it to.
That's cool. That's very
yeah.
Cool.
Oh shit. Well, this turned into something it wasn't supposed to be. It was what I set out to accomplish. So I think you read it and it's entertaining. I've read it like, I don't know, 50 times now. And
I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm not totally sick of it. So that.
That says something right there.
Says something.
Yeah.
It says something.
Well, that's awesome, man. Thank you so much for this chat. I hope the book goes incredibly well and you get to do your second and third. And from there on, for you guys, if you haven't checked out Mike's work yet, you want to do that. The gods of Google are on your side. All you have to do is type Mike Duncan in there, and I'm sure History of Rome will come up, Revolutions will come up, his Twitter account, you know, you name it, all the good stuff.
And while we're here, I should mention that there is a book tour, right, that's going to be coming out of all of this. So by the time that October the 24th rolls around, I will actually be in Boston. So I'll be in Boston and New York and Philadelphia and Washington, D.C., and then later like Chicago and L.A., San Francisco, Portland, Seattle.
Nice.
So if you go to thestormbeforethestorm.com or revolutionspodcast.com, there will be some information on where I will physically be. And if you're listening to this and you happen to be a fan of mine as well, you can come hang out. I'll do talks. I'll crack jokes. Ask your questions. You know, all the good stuff. I'll sign your book, and we'll all have a great time.
Excellent. I love it. Thank you so much, and thank you guys for listening. Have a very good day.
Oh, that was fun.
That's a wrap. I hope you guys have enjoyed this conversation. Now, a couple of quick things I want to mention. One, I forgot last time in the latest episode, the one about the Pirate Queen, I forgot to give a shout out to the History of China podcast. It was very, very, very sweet. They helped me with some of the research, giving me tips regarding where to look for sources. So check them out. Their Twitter is twitter.com/THOC podcast. So the initial for the History of China podcast. Check them out. And since I'm giving shout outs, also big one to History of Westeros.
These sweet folks, they have helped me put together a Patreon account. So those of you guys who have been donating via PayPal, you can continue to do so, but if you want to switch to Patreon, it may be easier just to have access to all the perks. Otherwise, I'll just figure out a way to get them to you anyway. But if you want to do that, or if you haven't donated at all and you are interested in either having access to some of the perks, which will include the early releases of the episodes, episodes without ads, bonus episodes, things like that, or you just simply want the podcast to stay viable for a while, check out patreon.com/historyonfire. Again, that's patreon.com/historyonfire. Also, a big thank you to 23andMe, since this episode of History on Fire is brought to you by 23andMe.com. 23andMe.com is a genetic service that can help you discover where your DNA comes from around the world. You can learn what percentage of your DNA comes from places like Italy, Finland, East Asia, and Africa. And with your 23andMe reports, you can explore your connection to the world in a whole new way by traveling to the places that reflect your DNA. So visit 23andme.com/HOF, standing for History on Fire. Again, that's the number 23, in the letters andme.com/HOF. Check them out. I'm actually planning to do it myself. I'm rather curious. So being from Italy means everything and nothing, right? Just about everybody in the world has invaded Italy at some point, so I'm curious to how far the whole the movement of genes, of how many people have come through, actually ended up in my family line. So I'm gonna find out. Also, big thank you to blueapron.com. They have been sponsoring every episode this year, and man, do I love their food. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. I really like the variety of offerings that they have. I really like the quality. And this October, Blue Apron is celebrating its 5th anniversary by bringing back the customer's top 20 favorite recipes from the last few years. You have a chance to check it out with $30 off your first meal with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onfire. So that way you don't have to take my word for it. You'll find out for yourself if what they offer is to your liking or not. I would bet that you would be, because the food quality is just amazing. But again, that's $30 off your first meal with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onfire. Also, big thank you to Onnit and Datsusara. You can visit onnit.com if you go to onnit.com/history and automatically receive a 10% discount. Their products, they include such a wide range of stuff that I use every day, from supplements to special foods, workout gear. They are getting in stock right now, this yoga mat that is, if you are a Star Wars nerd, you have imprinted into the mat Han Solo frozen in Jabba the Hutt's cave. Pretty fun. I think I want it. There's so much good stuff. I use a lot of their products. So check them out at onnit.com/history. And also check out dsgear.com. Datsusara is a company that specializes in backpacks, computer bags, travel bags, martial arts uniform, all sort of textiles that can be made with hemp. I really like the quality. All of my bags by now are Datsusara, so check them out. Having said this, big thank you to you sweet folks who have been using the History on Fire Amazon link to do your shopping. You know, maybe you buy books that we have mentioned on the podcast or other stuff. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It helps a bunch. As usual, you can check out my Facebook page, Daniele Bolelli, the public profile. It contains I regularly post about the podcast, you know, topics that we're going to tackle in the future and things like that. So if you are interested, check out my Facebook page. Having said all this, I will now shut up and wish you a very good day.